Accession number 15485, reel 3.
Colonel Thomas, reel 3.
The 1st U.S. Marine Division did not respond to a panicky instruction from General Armand, who commanded 10th Corps, which was on the east side of the Korean Peninsula. The 8th Army under General Walker, in which the British Commonwealth Brigade served, was on the other coast, and the gap between was filled by rather unreliable South Korean troops. General Armand, who also happened to be MacArthur's chief of staff as well as a field commander, and there's something wrong there, virtually flew in to Hagaruri, where General O.P. Smith, the Marine Divisional Commander, was, and virtually said, destroy all equipment, every man for himself. General Smith said, the Marines will withdraw. Well, they didn't use the word withdraw because they didn't like it. They thought it was synonymous with retreat. He said they will fight their way south, bringing all their equipment with them. And we were very lucky to be with such a fine fighting formation. Well, we were at Cauterie. Divisional headquarters was 10 miles further on at a village or town called Hagaruri on the southern tip of the Chosin Reservoir, which of course then was thoroughly frozen. It was quite clear that opposition was strengthening. Indeed, 7 Chinese divisions were directed onto the 1st Marine Division. And a force was formed called Force Drysdale, named after our CO. The Force Drysdale comprised G Company of the 1st Marines, 41 Commando, which wasn't much bigger than an American company, a company of the 33rd Regimental Combat Team, which was a U.S. Army formation, which was directed up the other side of the Chosin Reservoir, and subsequently ceased to exist, called Faith Force. They were completely decimated. Except 290 came back across the ice and formed a composite company, but I get ahead of myself. And components of the divisional train, in other words, the clerks and cooks and bottle washers and support personnel. And so Douglas Drysdale had this battalion size force, which was later joined by a U.S. Marine Corps tank company. And we set off at dawn on the 29th of November. And as in mountain warfare, you picket the heights in order to pass the column through up this one main supply route. But very soon we ran out of troops, and no sooner would you pull them off one mountain top or hilltop than the Chinese appear in their place. And so by midday we were bogged down. At this stage the tank company was allocated to Douglas Drysdale, and after a delay for them to refuel, we were ordered to fight our way through at all costs. Unfortunately, the tank commander, although he was under command, declined to do what he was told, which was to put his tanks in pairs throughout the convoy. There was clearly no enemy tank threat. Instead of that, he put them up with the George Company up at the front of the column, and apart from one tank which was abandoned when it ran out of fuel, they scarpered off for Hagaruri, to which we were all heading. The rest of the unit set off in the order with following George Company. We had the CO's headquarters group, which I was with as the weapons officer, although I must say we were geared up for an administrative move, and my mortars and machine guns were in fact crated, but we managed to break them out during the night in order to have some of the mortars ready for supporting fire. And then we had the US Army Company and then the divisional train. Well, we set off up the road, and night had fallen by now, and we were assailed at all sides from the Chinese who had closed up on the road, and they were firing burp guns, and they had satchels of explosive that they were throwing, and trying to interrogate people, it seemed that we were all ambushed and attacked at different points along the road. About halfway along, I remember very vividly that I was in Sontregrove's 1.5-ton truck, and the truck that was following me with the rest of my heavy weapons wasn't there. We were being fired at, so I waited for some considerable time, heard a lot of firing down the road, and debated whether I should go back, which I don't think was really on, and would have been contrary to orders anyway. And I went on up the road, and I found a whole lot of burning trucks, which were blocking the road. I managed to circumvent them, came up with a sergeant who had a truck full of wounded. I'd picked up quite a lot of wounded by then. I found a track through the paddy fields which diverted round where these burning trucks were blocking it, and then came across the first American outposts of Hegaruri. I might say rather bizarrely, as we were fighting our way up, we could look across at Hegaruri, which under a blaze of lights and bulldozers were cutting out an airfield in this very thinly guarded perimeter. And so we entered Hegaruri. I was the last vehicle through. Sadly, a lot of our people who fought in small pockets during the night were rounded up the next day. A number escaped, most notably under Captain, later to be Major General Pat Ovens, who brought them back into Coterie, and a large number, particularly of the US Army and Divisional Train, regrettably surrendered. I think the Chinese were quite good. They allowed some of the wounded to find their own way back. And I remember one I went to see afterwards. He was allowed actually to find a burnt out Jeep. All the tires had been burnt out. He was allowed to collect a battery from another vehicle, and they started this Jeep and drove back into Coterie. We then found ourselves in a very hotly contested perimeter, and the bulk of the United States Marine Corps rifle companies were 8 miles further on at Udamni, and they had a most fearful time in sub-zero temperatures. And we were the divisional reinforcements, those that were only about 100 of us got through, reinforcing bits of the perimeter as the Chinese were breaking through. And we went out part of the way along the road to see these fine fighting companies of the US Marines dragging their way back into the Hegaruri perimeter. And another time we went back to try and recover some 155mm guns which had been abandoned on the withdrawal. But we couldn't get the tractors going, so we had some demolitions men with us, and we demolished the guns. They were the biggest losses of the Marine Division in that fighting withdrawal. Having got back to Hegaruri, the division regrouped. The 1st and 5th Regimental Combat Teams were actually reinforced. More men marched out than had gone in, even though we evacuated the wounded from this airstrip, which by then was working. And we had the most magnificent support from the US Navy and Marine flyers, from the 7 aircraft carriers which were grouped around to help the withdrawal. And I particularly remember the crank wing Corsairs coming in. The American Marines had developed close air support to a fine art in the Pacific War. And they were actually coming in at night between the mountain peaks, strafing the Chinese who were gathering round to assault us. So after a few days' pause, we then set off south, first of all from Hagaruri down to Kotori, and all the divisional transport took up the 10 miles of road, and we were moved like a great dumbbell with the regimental combat team in front and the 5th Marines at the rear, to which we were attached. And we made the withdrawal. I think it took a day and a night to get from Hagaruri to the perimeter at Kotori. I well remember seeing the effect of napalm on the snow, because the Chinese had little quilted jackets. One side was khaki and the other side was white for snow warfare. And the poor sods only had gym shoes. I had my machine guns. I had a couple left. And remember shooting the white coats on the blackened snow. But again, one didn't have any compunction, because it was either them or us. Well, we got back into Kotori, where we regrouped. And then we're ready for the next stage of the withdrawal, which was down through the Funchilin Pass. And we, I remember we had to go and garrison a hill peak or mountain peak as part of the perimeter, which was the coldest night of my life. I couldn't dig, it was frozen too solid. And then we came down as part of the rear guard and marched down through the Funchilin Pass. I think the American tanks, there was a broken bridge and a bridge, a girder bridge had to be lowered to bridge this gap, which caused some considerable delay. But we marched down through the Funchilin Pass, down, I think we were shelled as we came through by the Puerto Ricans, which was a bit of a slap in the face, but when we got down inside the perimeter, which was being held for us by the 1st Marines, 1st Regimental Combat Team, they then had trucks for us who motored us down to a holding camp at Hung Nam, and that's where I got frostbite, I think, having marched 28 miles, but then sit in freezing trucks with these dreadful shoe packs we were wearing. And then we were in this holding camp in a sea of mud, and were then taken out to transports which were waiting for us that took us round to Maesan, just down in South Korea by Pusan. We spent Christmas 1950 there, and then because of the reinforcement situation, we'd lost a lot of specialists, signalers, assault engineers, half of my heavy weapons personnel, more than half, went. It was decided we'd go back to Japan to wait for reinforcements. We went to Ebisu Camp in the outskirts of Tokyo. I think our CO decided that idleness was not good for morale, so we decided to launch a unit raid up at a place called Songjin, which is only some 70 miles from the Russian border, Vladivostok area. And so we started the only daylight raid we did, and we embarked in the APDs, the Horace A. Bass and the Wontuck, an LPD, Landing Platform Dock, the Fort Marion. We had massive support from the USS St. Helena, which was a cruiser, a number of destroyers, air power, and we went into Songjin in daylight in Amtraks, armored amphibians. And we were 8 hours ashore. A few Chinese units, or they might have been North Korean, appeared and fired at long distance, but didn't mount a formal assault. Sadly, a number of villagers had been killed and wounded, but our medical personnel looked after those. And within this perimeter, the assault engineers, who are trained to a much higher degree than sort of ordinary pioneers, under Pat Ovens, first of all, put some beehive charges in the embankment, which blew holes as long, as deep as the camouflage, what would that be, about 8-10 feet into the embankment. These were then cooled with fire extinguishers bought from the ships. They were packed with explosives, and a first charge, cratering charge, would be set off. We then camouflaged again and went down another 8-10 feet, put another cratering charge in, so you ended up with about 20-foot craters, and then the lips were sown with anti-personnel mines, and then we withdrew. So that was the Songjin raid.
How did the villagers get killed?
By the preliminary bombardment before we went ashore. Then we withdrew, and I think we had no casualties at all, but it did give a bit of a fillip to the unit to feel they were doing something at last. By this time, reinforcements were starting to arrive to replace those we'd lost, and it was decided that the commando would go up and garrison the islands inside Wonsan Harbour, which is a big natural harbour, rather a G shape with a peninsula either side and a large area which had been swept clear of sea mines but was always occupied by three United Nations destroyers. Sometimes we had bigger vessels in. I well remember seeing the mighty Mo, the Missouri, coming in firing rapid broadsides. But perhaps the most impressive was a little LCR, landing craft rocket, which came in firing ripples of rockets as they came in. Anyway, we were garrisoned on islands within this North Korean harbor, and we stayed there for the rest of our time in Korea. The headquarters island was called Modo. There was a leper colony which was evacuated called Taedo. There was a little island which was within mortar range of the North Koreans called Wangtado, which is where I was based with the mortars and a recoilless 106mm recoilless rifle. And we used that both to garrison the islands and for raids both inside the harbour and outside the harbour. What became apparent, I think, and our commanding officers changed this time, General Grant took over from Douglas Drysdale, who had had really a very rough time because he'd not only been the operational commander, but he'd also been responsible for planning, for resupply, and life was difficult. We couldn't get paid in anything we could spend with the Americans to start with because BAFS, British Armed Forces currency, was so much dirty paper we needed dollars, and we didn't get any dollars for some time, so the troops went unpaid. And these sort of things, as well as trouble with the Australians who wanted to get operational control over us and things like that. So he was looking to about 5 different headquarters as well as operational command of his unit. So he was worn out. And he was relieved by Colonel F.N. Grant, Chips Grant, just for the last few months. And it became apparent that probably because of our raiding activities, we couldn't set foot on the coast without incurring casualties. There were several raids where casualties were taken. And it was decided, probably because of the demands of three commander brigade in Malaya, that we couldn't sustain this small operation in Korea. So at the end of 1951, we were withdrawn. Those with more than a year's service came home. Those with less than a year were disembarked at Singapore and went and joined Three Commander Brigade. And the unit was finally disbanded in February 1952 on Plymouth Barracks Parade Ground.
We're talking about 41 Independent Commando.
And that was the last of 41 Independent Commando.
Just going back to the fighting at the Chosin Reservoir, what was your opinion of the Chinese enemy as a fighting soldier?
Well, there was something which I don't think that European troops, except, of course, the British in Burma, had come across, which was an Asiatic peasant army which could endure the most fearful hardships, was impervious, or jolly nearly impervious, to interdiction by air power, and could sustain a major offensive purely by using man and woman power to shift enormous quantities of munitions down to the front. They were very brave. They controlled themselves by bugles and shouting, no radio sets, and they were able to give a very big, powerful United States division a very rough time. When I say that there were seven divisions directed against the one, of course the Chinese divisions were much smaller and probably much more lightly equipped, but they were still a pretty formidable foe. And we caught very few prisoners. The photograph of one in that book.
Now, I think that later in your career you served in Aden and the Radfan. Can you tell me how that came about, please?
Well, before then I was in Cyprus for
Let's do that in chronological order then, please. Yeah. The Ayoka period.
Yes, after a stint in training establishments and on the staff of the Royal Naval College at Greenwich, I went out to join 40 Commando again, which was based in Cyprus, having just returned from the Suez operation. As soon as I arrived, I was informed that we were off to Cyprus the next day, and the commandos at that time from the brigade were doing a kind of roulement, which is an incorrect word, actually. It was the word used by the French when they were rolling troops up to be massacred on the Western Front in the First World War, but it really means a routine transfer of troops. And a commando at a time was based in Cyprus for 3 or so months.
Which year are we talking about now?
56. And the task of the commandos was to cover the Trudos Mountain area. In hindsight, that was a mistake, because we were garrisoning the mountain tops, but the routes of supply, which the ordinary Cypriots, and hence the guerrillas, used, was up the valleys. And if you cut off the heads of the valleys by putting a different unit at the top, you couldn't really follow your intelligence up the same routes that the guerrillas, terrorists, call them what you will, were using. Anyway, my troop at that time was used to garrison Kiko Monastery, which had been the monastery where Grievous had been training and arming his Ioka terrorists.
Which was your troop then?
A support troop still. There were still mortars and machine guns. But we didn't have them with us at that time, of course. There were only seven monks left in the monastery, which was a sort of pilgrim monastery and therefore had lots of accommodation, which is where we put the troops. But there was a very fine chief monk left called Father Yerasimos, who was very correct towards us, never collaborated, though we were civil to one another, and I used to ask him across for a meal, and he used to ask us across for a meal. Occasionally, excuse me. Sad to say, within a few months of the monks having been released from detention after the emergency was over, he was poisoned because he was thought to have been a collaborator. However, we used Kiko as a patrol base to dominate our area of the Trudos Mountains to make sure that the villages were not harbouring terrorists, or try to, or that the terrorists were using it as a training ground as they'd been doing before. And so that was our role there. I didn't think we had any particular successes or losses during that first phase. We then went back to Malta for more training because we, of course, were the amphibious reserve. We used to go across to Tripoli for training, Tahuna Camp, which was some 60 miles in the desert from Tripoli, which was a fine training area. And then I went back again for another tour in the Cyprus Mountains. This time I was at the top of what I call the Naughty Valley, from Lefka, which was Turkish, up through the villages of Pedalas, Mutulas, Prodromus, and I was in a holiday camp. My troop, I had command of two troops then, was in the holiday camp of Pinewoods with a detachment at Kiko Monastery, and we had quite a big area to cover where we were doing much the same sort of patrolling and looking for the wanted terrorists. We all carried their photographs and their names of their home villages and this sort of thing. But the major event which I remember was Operation Kingfisher, which was a 48-hour cordon and search, which ended up in 6 weeks of rather abortive work just inland from Limassol. A word had got around that Grievous was holding a planning meeting with some of his lieutenants in an area of farming land. And I think it was three battalions were moved in to form a cordon so the area could be searched. And you can just imagine these trucks grinding through the night in Cyprus, and nobody's supposed to know, but I think the telephone wires was red hot. Anyway, we were given our cordon area. The Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders formed another one, and various companies like the Lancashire Fusiliers and others came in. And we stayed there for 6 weeks. I was commanding support troop, which also had the assault engineers in it, and we were looking for hides in this area, which was limestone. Specialists were flown out from England. I remember one geologist came out, a professor, and said, "Ah, yes, these rocks, oh yes, they're very..."